Consumed with eagerness to reach Nativity Bay, Jim's hopes and longings ran ahead of the slow procession of wagons and grazing herds. He wanted to leave the caravan to ride for the coast at once. He urged Louisa to accompany him, but Zama's recovery from the bullet wound was slow. Louisa insisted that he still needed her care, and she could not leave him. "You go on ahead," she told him. Even though he was sure she did not truly mean him to leave her, and that she expected him to refuse, he was sorely tempted to take her at her word. But then he recalled that Kurtz, Odoman, and the Arab assassin Kadam were still at large and might be in the offing. He could not leave Louisa alone. Each morning he and Bakat rode out far ahead of the caravan to scout the road path, and he made certain that he returned before sunset each evening to be with Louisa. They emerged from the bottom end of the narrow gorge into a country lush with grasslands and fair hills interspersed with green forests. Each day Bakat found sign of the elephant herds, but none fresh enough to follow up until the morning of the fifth day after leaving the gorge. As usual, he was riding just ahead of Jim, breaking trail and scanning ahead for sign, when suddenly he turned Crow aside and reined him to a standstill. Jim came up beside him. "What is it?" Bakat pointed wordlessly at the damp earth and the tracks deeply trodden into it. Jim felt his pulse jump with excitement. "Elephant!"
"Eh, three big bulls," Bakat agreed. "And very fresh. They passed this way in the dawn of this very morning, not long since."
Jim felt his anxiety to reach Nativity Bay abate as he stared at the spoor.
"They're very big," he said. "One is a king of all elephants," Bakat said. "It may be as large as the first great beast you slew."
"They cannot be too far ahead of us," Jim suggested hopefully. There had been many successful hunts since the battle with Manatasi's impis on the river bank. Each time they caught up with the great ivory-bearing bulls, Jim added to his fund of experience and knowledge of their habits, but now he had honed his skills as a hunter, and in so doing had become addicted to the dangers and the fascination of the chase after this most noble quarry. "How long will it take to catch up with them?" he asked Bakat.
"They are feeding as they go, moving slowly,"
Bakat pointed out the torn branches of the trees from which the bulls had fed.
"And they are heading down towards the coast along our line of march. We need not detour to follow them."
Bakat spat thoughtfully and looked up at the sky. He held up his right hand and measured his spread of fingers against the angle of the sun.
"If the gods of the hunt are kind, we might catch them before noon and still be back at the wagons before nightfall."
These days Bakat showed a reluctance equal to Jim's to spend a night away from the wagons and the golden charms of Letty. Jim was torn. Despite his passion for the chase, his love and concern for Louisa were stronger. He knew that the vagaries of the hunt were unpredictable. To follow the bulls might add a day or more to the journey to the coast. They might not be able to return to the wagons before the onset of night. On the other hand, there had been no sign of Kurtz and his Arab ally since that disastrous night attack. Bakat had swept the back trail for many leagues, and it was clear there seemed no longer to be a threat from that direction. Even so, dare he leave Louisa for so long? He wanted desperately to follow the tracks. In the months of hunting he had learned to read the spoor so vividly that he could picture them in his mind's eye, and he knew that these were magnificent bulls. He vacillated for a while longer while Bakat squatted patiently beside the huge oval pad marks and waited for him to make up his mind. Then Jim thought of the small army of men who were with the wagons to guard and protect Louisa. Kurtz's force had been routed and decimated. Surely he would not return so soon. At last he convinced himself that Kurtz was heading either for Portuguese or Omani territory, that he would not double back to attack them again.
"Every minute I dither here, the bulls are walking away from me," he made up his mind. "Bakat, take the spoor and eat the wind."
They rode hard and closed the gap swiftly. The spoor headed steadily through the low hills and forest towards the coast. In places, the raw trunks of the trees from which the elephant had stripped the bark shone like mirrors a cable's length ahead of them, and they could push Drumfire and Crow into a canter. A little before noon they came upon a huge mound of spongy yellow dung, composed mostly of half-digested bark. It was lying in a puddle of urine that had not yet soaked away into the earth. The dung was covered by a swarm of butterflies with gorgeous white, yellow, and orange wings. Bakat dismounted and thrust his bare toe into the moist pile to test the temperature. The butterflies rose around him in a cloud.
"Eh, the dung is still hot from his belly," he grinned up at Jim. "If you called his name, the bull is so close he would hear your voice."
The words were no sooner out of Bakat's mouth than they both froze and their heads turned together.
"Ha!" Jim grunted. "He heard you speak."
In the forest, not far ahead, the elephant trumpeted again, high and clear as a bugle blast. Agile as a cricket, Bakat sprang into the saddle.
"What has alarmed them?"
Jim asked, as he drew his big German four-to-the-pound gun from its sheath under his knee.
"Why did he trumpet? Did he catch our wind?"
"Eh-eh, the wind is in our faces," Bakat replied. "They have not smelt us, but something else has done it."
"Sweet Mary," Jim shouted with astonishment, "that's musket fire."
The heavy reports of the guns boomed out, and the echoes were flung back by the surrounding hills.
"Is it Kurtz?" Jim demanded,
then answered himself,
"Ah, it cannot be.
Kurtz would never give himself away while he knows we're close. These are strangers, and they are attacking our herd." Jim felt a flare of anger. These were his elephant. The interlopers had no right to intervene in his hunt. He felt a strong urge to rush forward, but he quelled that dangerous inclination. He did not know who these other hunters might be. Judging by the fusillade of gunfire, he knew that there was more than one. Any stranger in the wilderness might be a deadly threat. Suddenly there was another sound, the crackle of breaking branches and the rush of an enormous body bearing down on them through the thick underbrush ahead.
"Hey, be ready, Somoya!" Bakat called urgently. "They have driven one of their bulls back towards us. He may be wounded and dangerous."
Jim had only time enough to swing drumfire to face the sound, when the green forest wall ahead burst open and a bull elephant was upon him at full charge. In that moment of sudden danger, time seemed to slow, as though he were caught in the coils of a nightmare. He saw curved tusks that seemed as massive as the main beams of a cathedral roof high above him, and the ears spread wide as the mainsail of a man-o'-war, tattered by shot after a close-fought battle. There was fresh blood smeared down the elephant's flank, and fury in his tiny gleaming eyes as they fastened on Jim. Bakat had guessed correctly. The gigantic animal was wounded and enraged. Jim realized that flight would be fatal, for Drumfire would not be able to use his speed in the confines of the thorn underbrush, while the bull would thrash through it without check. Jim could not fire from the saddle. Drumfire was dancing in a circle under him and tossing his head. His antics would upset Jim's aim. Holding the heavy gun high above his head, so that it would not hit him in the face as he landed, Jim threw one leg back over the cantle of the saddle and dropped to the ground, landing like a cat facing the charge. He cocked the gun as his feet touched the earth. His fear was gone in that instant, replaced by a strange feeling of detachment, as though he stood outside himself and watched the gun come up. Without conscious thought, he knew that if he sent a ball through the beast's heart, its stride would not even check. It would still rip him limb from limb as effortlessly as a butcher dismembers a chicken carcass, then walk another mile before it succumbed. After his first near-fatal experience with the headshot, Jim had spent hours and days carefully dissecting and studying the skulls of all the other elephant he had killed since then. Now he could visualize the exact location of the brain in the massive casket of the skull, as though it was not solid bone but clear glass. As the buttstock came into his shoulder, he seemed not to see the iron sights of the weapon, but he looked through them to his tiny concealed target. The shot thundered out. He was instantly blinded by the dense fog of gun smoke and driven back on his heels by the recoil. Then, out of the smoke bank, a grey avalanche toppled down on him. He was struck by an enormous slack weight. The heavy gun was wrenched from his grip and he was hurled backwards. He rolled twice, head over heels, until he hit a low bush, which brought him up short. He struggled up just as the light breeze blew aside the curtains of silver gun smoke and saw the bull elephant kneeling before him on its front legs, with the curve of the huge tusks resting on the earth and the tips pointing up to the sky. It seemed to be an attitude of submission, like a trained elephant waiting to be mounted by a mahout. It was as still and motionless as a granite boulder. There was a round, dark hole low between its eyes. It was so close that he reached up and thrust his forefinger full length into it. The pewter hardened ball, a quarter of a pound in weight, had cleaved the massive frontal bones of the skull and driven through to the brain. When he withdrew his finger, it was smeared with custard yellow brain tissue. Jim stood up and leaned heavily on one of the tusks. Now that the danger was past, his breathing came hard and ragged, and his legs shook under him so that they could scarcely bear his weight. While he clung to the great curve of ivory and swayed on his feet, Buckart rode in and seized Drumfire before he could bolt. He brought him back to Jim and handed him the reins. "Hey, my teaching begins to bear fruit," he giggled. "Oh, now you must give thanks and respect to your quarry." It was some minutes before Jim could gather himself to complete the ancient ritual of the hunt. Under Bakat's approving eye, he broke off a leafy twig of the sweet thorn and placed it between the bull's lips. "Eat your last meal to sustain you on the journey to the Shadowland. Take with you my respect," he said. Then he cut off the tail, like his father before him. Jim had not forgotten the other musket shots he had heard. But as he stooped to retrieve his fallen musket, he noticed again the thick coating of blood down the bull's flank and saw a bullet wound high in its right shoulder. "Buckat, this animal has been wounded before my shot," he called sharply. Before Buckat could reply, another human voice close at hand shouted a challenge or a question. It was so unexpected, yet so familiar, that Jim stood with the empty gun in his hand and gaped at the tall, athletic figure striding towards him through the undergrowth. A white man, dressed in European-style breeches and jacket, boots, and a wide-brimmed straw hat. "Hey there, fellow! What the devil do you think you're playing at? I drew first blood, the kill is mine!" The voice rang as joyously as church bells in Jim's ears. Under the brim of the hat, the interloper's beard curled red and wild as a bushfire. Jim recovered his wits at once and shouted back just as belligerently, "By God, you saucy knave!" It required an effort to keep the laughter out of his tone. "You will have to fight me for it, and I will crack your pate as I have done 50 times before." The saucy knave stopped dead in his tracks and stared at Jim, then let out a wild hurrah and rushed at him. Jim dropped his musket and charged headlong to meet him. They came together with a violence that rattled their teeth. "Jim, oh, what joy! I thought we would never find you. Mansa, I hardly recognized you with that fluffy red bush sprouting all over your face. Where in the name of the devil have you been?" They gabbled incoherently as they hugged and buffeted each other and tried to pull handfuls of hair from each other's heads and faces. Buckart watched them, shaking his head and slapping his sides with amusement. "And you, you little hooligan!" Mansa seized him, lifting him off his feet and tucked him under his arm, then embraced Jim again. It took some time for them to begin to behave like sensible persons, but gradually they got themselves under a semblance of control. Mansa replaced Buckart on his feet, and Jim released Mansa from the headlock in which he had pinned him. They sat shoulder to shoulder, leaning against the dead elephant's side, in the shadow cast by the massive carcass, and talked, cutting in on each other, hardly waiting for the reply to one question before asking another. Every now and then Mansa would tug at Jim's beard, and Jim would punch him affectionately in the chest or slap his hairy cheek. Though neither mentioned it, each of them was amazed at the changes that had taken place in the other during the time they had been apart. They had become men. Then the retinue who had accompanied Mansa came looking for him. They were all servants from High Weald or sailors from the schooners. They were astonished to find Jim with their master. After Jim had greeted them affectionately, he set them to work under the supervision of Bakat to cut out the tusks from the fallen bull. Then he and Mansur could continue their exchange of news, trying to cover in minutes all that had overtaken them and the family since their last meeting nearly 2 years ago. "Where's Louisa, the girl you ran off with? Did she have the sense to send you packing?" Mansur demanded. "By God, cuz, I tell you, that is a pearl of a lass. Presently I'll take you back to the wagons to be properly introduced to her. You will not credit your eyes when you see her how lovely she has grown." Then Jim broke off and his expression changed. "I know not how best to tell you, cuz, but only a few weeks past I fell in with a deserter from the gift of Allah. You must remember the rogue. His name is Rashud. He had a strange and terrible tale to tell, once I could drag it out of him." The colour drained from Mansur's face, and for a minute he could not speak. Then he blurted out, "He must have been in the company of two other of our sailors, all three deserters, and there would have been a strange Arab with them. One named Kadem ibn Abu Bakr al-Juf." Mansur started up. "Where is he?" "He murdered my mother and almost killed my father." "I know it. I forced the whole story from Rashud." Jim tried to calm him. "My heart breaks for you. I loved Aunt Yassi almost as much as you did. But the assassin has escaped." "Tell me, all of it," Mansur demanded. "Spare me not a single detail." There was so much to tell, and they sat so long telling it that the sun was low on the horizon before Jim stood up. "We must get back to the wagons before nightfall. Louisa will be beside herself."